You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Matthew Friday and Ian Kerr. We're going to be talking about the collective Spurs. Matthew and Ian, thanks for being with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to talk about what Spurs is. It's a design and consultation collective, as I understand it. But perhaps you could each introduce yourselves. Matthew first, by just talking about your role at Spurs and how you define.
Sure.
Let's say the goals of Spurs.
Yeah, I could just start first. I encountered Ian and the rest of the Spurs crew about 15 years ago, and they had already been working together for a few years previous to that. At the time, I was really coming from a background of activism and community organizing as well as art. I became very interested in what Spurs is doing because it seemed to offer some really novel ways of engaging communities of both humans and also non-humans outside of the sort of usual paradigm of activism and art. So I began collaborating with them and have been working for the past 15 years. And now I find myself as the graduate director of the Masters of Fine Arts program at State University of New York at New Paltz. I'm in pretty close proximity with a number of other Spurs members. And as you noted, we're a research and design collective with a membership of approximately 10 people coming from really all sorts of different skill sets. We've got people that are, designers and urban architects and carpenters, electricians, citizen scientists, artists, skateboarders, you name it. And we sort of pool our knowledge approach every project as sort of a unique opportunity for research and as a unique possibility of working with new people around new problems. So maybe Ian can jump in and extrapolate some more.
Yeah, Ian?
Yeah. I mean, that was beautiful, Matthew. I always like to start with what you had said, that, we're design consultation service, because that often sounds odd to people. And it's kind of deliberately so. We're interested in design in the broadest sense. Like, for us, everything is designed in the sense that everything's made, everything needs to be constructed, whether it's an idea, a concept, an ecosystem, it's all made. And so it's all a question of design. And then the consultation part's really important to us, which is to say, to do anything, to make anything, is to work with others. And for us, we try to work with others as equal. And by that, I mean, we see ideas as collaborators, language as collaborators, tools as collaborators, as Matthew was saying, humans and non-humans. All of those play a significant agential role in making. And so we really avoid categories that bring to mind specific forms of outcomes, like when you say art or an artist, and we'd rather just see us as collaborative makers, so consultative designers. And, Matthew pointed out there's like 10 of us. We've been working together for about 20 years almost. It's very flexible organization. Everybody does everything. When projects come along, whoever's interested and available can take any role they feel they're interested in. And we draw on our skill sets, as Matthew was saying, from, urbanism, ecology, architecture, philosophy, computer science, and on and on. To sort of rethink whatever question we're given come up with a novel problem and develop. I think, you know, the other thing that makes us unique is we really try to develop everything by imagining that we could make a new mode of being in the world with the project, not simply continue an existing one or solve a problem. So there's always like an ontological, cosmological stake in what we do.
And let's talk about one of those projects then. So then you can kind of walk through and, you know, illustrate so much of what you've just been saying in terms of how the collaborative works. What would be a good project to either of you think to kind of describe how it went a little bit from beginning to end that was particularly successful or somehow, you know, explicative of the collaborative nature of your work?
Hey, Matthew, do you want to just talk about what we're working on right now with each
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. So I think it's an ongoing project, but one that's, you know, fresh on our minds and has been evolving since about 2011. It's a project we're calling Eat Your Sidewalk, and it's also the title of a book we just recently published. That's a sort of combination urban foraging guide, a history of the sort of cosmological implications of eating, a lot of inquiry into non-Western anthropology as it relates to the concept of eating. And so it's a project that evolved out of our participation in the BMW Guggenheim Lab back in 2011. And we were invited in to do a series of workshops around the theme of urbanism. And one of the things that caught our attention right away is the fact that roughly 75 to 80% of all humans live in what's considered an urban environment now. And since the majority of populations are located in these environments, I think it's really important for us to come up with novel ways to rethink those possibilities and to redesign our modes of living in cities with others. And what we encountered as we were doing a number of tours throughout New York City, looking at sort of infrastructure, the way food comes in and moves through the city, was this sort of deep inherent divide between nature and culture. And it's present within our architecture, within our language, within our eating practices, you know, within our religions, all of that, within our art that people produce as well. In fact, the very idea of art comes out of this divide between nature and culture. And so we became really interested in it and particularly excited by the possibility of thinking outside of that particular binary. And the reason it was so problematic became apparent when we, at least for me in particular, I think a lot of the other members of Spurs, when we did a tour with a number of BMW executives and magazine representatives along the Hackensack River in New Jersey. And New Jersey is, of course, the sort of like dumping grounds for all of the shit that New York City doesn't want to deal with. So it's, you know, historically had these illegal, dumps that were managed by the mafia. It's been a place where people have left chemical waste. And at the same time, it's this really amazing and robust and fertile emergent ecology with all sorts of hybrid and mutant creatures that are evolving within this area. But we, this sort of division between nature and culture led to what we thought of as like an island mentality, where people in Western society tend to view their cities as like failed ecologies, which they don't have to care for anymore. And their mode of caring becomes only about purchasing, you know, the nice organic pasture raised, you know, free range, whatever, from organic gardens somewhere else. And so it always comes down to this debate about like conserving, you know, pure nature that's external, that's far away, and living in what's seen as this sort of failed ecology of the city. And so we wanted to devise ways of getting people to really care about what's immediately under their feet. And maybe I'll pause there and let Ian jump in, because that's where we started to develop some of the Eat Your Sidewalk projects and practices.
Yeah. So, I mean, as Matthew was saying, you know, we wanted people to start and care with what's right under their feet and even knowing it. So we started to, you know, get people and introduce the idea of foraging and urban foraging, and with this really simple premise that, you know, when you eat something you pick from right under your feet, whatever happened to it is now happening to you. And you now share, you know, have a shared history, a shared makeup, and a shared set of concerns and future. You know, so if you're going to really eat that, you better figure out how to care for how that dandelion's growing. And, you know, so this, you know, this was kind of the seed of a whole way of thinking about how do we co-shape, co-make ecosystems with, you know, dandelions, bacteria, fungi, other animals, peoples, cultures, and how we can, you know, also get out of this idea that it's, you know, private property, don't disturb. And that model is even a model of nature, like you should only take pictures, but you shouldn't interact with it. So we wanted people to become dependent on their actual environments. You know, and I think for us, you know, the very idea of capitalism is to produce a type of independence from anywhere. If you can't get something here, you get it there. If this isn't working, do it that way. If this species is dying out, just clone it or have it in a zoo. And so we developed all of these programs around foraging, guidebooks, a cookbook, classes. We've also developed landscapes. We've worked with neighborhoods, universities, to make a type of multi-species edible landscape.
This is in itself a multi-species edible landscape. I mean that in itself is obviously a huge project with a lot of research in it, but that also is over the many elements and a nice way of articulating the kind of this project in general, isn't it? This kind of you know,
yeah, absolutely. We really like to think of it as like a multi-species commons, like the ideal way to think of what we might call public space. Social space is really a multi-species commons, like where we and everything else that's there have to negotiate our mutual interdependencies. And we have to have some stake in the game, which is the eating part, you know, that, you know, in our current world, we don't really have a stake in any actual place, you know, and so that's the other really big part of it. It's all about placemaking, you know, and how we and other creatures and systems make places. We want to just awaken people in a sense, to the pleasure of this. And that's, I guess, also why eating really matters. Eating's, you know, pleasurable. It's not, we're not interested in berating people, having long critiques of whatever it might be, but actually starting and ending in wonderment, you know, about what's right under your feet.
I like that. So, so this is the current project, but it's multifaceted, obviously, and it seems like it requires a lot. To talk just a little bit about the funding for this, because some of it sounds like it's it can take all different forms. Who is the the client in a sense for this?
That's a good question.
Matthew. A question, but just to get at that. You
know. No, it's a crucial one to us.
Yeah, yeah, it really is, and it's something, you know, we're constantly trying to figure out. I mean, I'd first say that we realized really, I think, pretty quickly that the conventional structures of the art world couldn't sustain the type of research that interested us. You know, they're typically set up for relatively short duration, low impact, you know, exhibitions that privilege a certain type of interaction. It's certainly still interaction, but it's a particular type that doesn't engender the sort of deep transformative actions that interested us. So really for at least, you know, the past, well, for you know, our duration of working together, we've been looking for both alternative ways of funding it and alternative ways of reaching communities. And so we've come up with a lot of different strategies. You know, we certainly go the conventional route of grant applications, where we've had some success, we've been looking more and more towards grants that exist outside the realm of arts. Again, the art grants tend to be, you know, really competitive and not as much as some of the grants that one can locate within, say, the sciences, with non-governmental organizations. We've done a lot of collaborations where the collaborator is able to provide in-kind resources. And maybe just to like cite one specifically that Ian talked about, we had a multi-year engagement with Pitzer College, which is part of the Claremont College Consortium right outside of Los Angeles. And they had received a Mellon grant for large-scale art and ecology projects on their campus and selected us to be one of the visiting groups to come in and work with them. And that provided us with a good amount of resources, but we were really able to capitalize on the project by forging these sort of alliances with both the community partners within and outside of the university. And, you know, for example, like the dining hall staff and the grounds crew. So those partnerships often enable us to extend the impact of our projects beyond just the revenue streams. So that's one example.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we've engaged, mm-hmm. as I mentioned, we published this book called Eat Your Sidewalk, and we're in the process of meeting with publishers. Right now we've self-published it through Amazon, but we're looking into the possibility of working with, you know, large-scale non-academic publishers as a means of disseminating that research and also funding more research like that. So those are, you know, a couple examples.
I would add, I mean, really fast in there, Matthew, mm-hmm. like the cookbook itself is a Kickstarter project. So we've mm-hmm. used things like Kickstarter. We've run...
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but is the cookbook still a Kickstarter project currently?
Well, it was successful, so we raised the money to do the writing and the publishing of it, and now, you know, it's a standalone book which you can purchase if you go to like eatyoursidewalk.org, or you can just find it on Amazon. You know, and so that's another part of trying to make things that, you know, it looks and it feels like a coffee table book. It's like something attractive and enjoyable that can just circulate on its own terms. You know, and so that's the other thing is we try to think of like multi-scaled, multi-pronged approaches. So there's, like as Matthew was saying, like, you know, we worked with Pitzer to essentially develop landscape design, urban landscape design. We wrote the cookbook to reach anybody, you know, any foodie that's interested. We got Rene Redzepi said it's like a critical philosophical take in foraging today. So, you know, it's sort of reached a larger discourse. You know, and then we do things like small pop-up restaurants,
mm-hmm.
Tours, you know, and then find also other very like cheap distribution methods. But any project, like for us, all our projects end up being multi-year endeavors, which often, like to get back to this idea of client, the client and the user are often totally different groups. You know, so the money might be coming from one source, but really to give something out to other people in very different ways. And
Right. So they could cross over. There's crossovers, as you're saying, between Kickstarter and other forms of support and exchange.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we're really interested in the commons environment and community of sharing, skill sharing, and knowledge sharing, and so we work a lot in that.
And how can the audience that's listening, you know, get to know more about you, or is there something that you would suggest for people who want to learn more about what you're doing? There's, of course, there's links here to your site, and they can see more, but can they buy the cookbook, or is there a particular way you'd suggest that people learn more about what you're doing?
Matthew, jump in.
Sure. The probably easiest and cheapest way to buy the cookbook is to get it directly from us, from the eatyoursidewalk.org website. It's less expensive than Amazon, but of course you can locate that on Amazon, so it's pretty easily available for circulation. We have a website, spurs.org, which is an archive of our projects and our writing. And those are the two main sites. I'm trying to think of other places we would pair. We recently did an interview with Clock Tower Radio. And if you just search for Spurs and Clock Tower Radio, you can find there's a nice interview there. And then the Pitzer website, if you go to Pitzer and just type in multi-species commons in their search, you'll see the website that we developed, which is for that project, which is pretty intensive and has a lot of documentation. And it's also a really interesting interactive website in that it allows people in that location to sort of locate and identify edible, medicinal, and material-based plants that can be used, and to write and share information about it. So it's a pretty exciting interactive website.
Okay, well, those links will be in here as well in the interview for people listening. And before we go, I want to ask you both the potentially very long question. What are you reading right now? Either one of you could start, perhaps Matthew.
I just, as you asked that, I realized I forgot to say one other really important thing. Ian published a really fantastic essay about the sort of future of thinking outside of art in a book called Problems and Provocations. It was published by Grand Arts, that I would really encourage everyone to read. And I put that on my reading list.
Yeah, you can find that. I think it's like after art. If you just Google that, it might be like an academia.
Mm-hmm.
And so, who's and is it Ian? What are you reading, Ian?
Yeah, I've been reading two sort of sets of books. We're heading off to work in Beirut with an Eat Your Sidewalk project, and we're really interested in how, you know, as the pre-humans and humans migrated out of Africa, they went through the corridor of the Middle East up, you know, turned either right or left into Asia and towards Eurasia. And so I've been reading a bunch of books on that that are really interesting. One of the most beautiful is actually, it sounds like tangential, but it's this fantastic book called A Million Years of Music, subtitled The Emergence of Human Modernity. It's like how we became human by looking at this question of music. And Gary Tomlinson, musicologist, really great. He's at Yale, worth checking out. And then the other, you know, a big interest of ours is like experimenting with alternative cosmologies and ontologies. And in anthropology, there's a kind of movement called the ontological turn to look at other cultures, not as cultures, but as ontologies, like modes of being in the world. And there's a couple books we've been reading. One's called Cannibal Metaphysics by Vivero de Castro, which is this fantastic one, you know, where he's looking at animist cosmologies, you know, and in animist cosmologies, which is pretty much all the First Nations people of North and South America. I'm now generalizing really fast, see every creature as a type of human and every object. It just has a different sort of skin, and it gets more complicated. But, you know, he says really beautifully, like, if everything is a human, then the human is something entirely different, you know, and really brilliant stuff. And in parallel to that, last thing I'll say is a book by a Yanomami writer, so Brazilian First Nations people. The book's called The Falling Sky, and it's just this incredibly in-depth, representation of their worldview by, you know, a modern member of their that world. And, you know, and I think these are kind of books like we tend to all read and talk about the same books, mm-hmm. And share, you know, so that it's a really great question because we're always asking each other that and then reading similar stuff. And
it is in Matthew. Did you get in a book? You mentioned Ian's essay, but was there a book you're reading that you want to mention?
I mean, yeah, I would just add one more in there that we've been sort of jointly reading for a while that really relates to what Ian was saying in terms of the sort of ontological turn of thinking other societies as modes of being, and that's this awesome book called Beyond Nature and Culture by Philippe Discola. And so he's, you know, looking at different animist practices, but also doing sort of a anthropological history of Western thinking and where this sort of nature-culture divide comes from, and comparing that to cultures that really have no concept of nature. As it turns out, you know, nature is really like a construct of Western society. And so when you get rid of that, you get the really interesting examples that Ian was talking about of, you know, an animist culture that thinks everything, rocks and dragonflies and earthworms and trees, that they're all human. And so their whole, like, you know, mode of being offers some really exciting and interesting alternatives and for living in the world, and amazing examples of complicated linguistic technologies of how one has to speak and negotiate with others. So we've been sort of jointly reading that for a couple of years, and it's really informed our practice.
Well, Matthew and Ian, I want to thank you both for talking with me today and for sharing some about Spurs. I wish you the best with your upcoming work.
Thank you so much.
Hey, it's a real pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.